Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Safety Insurance, offering auto insurance policies designed to help for when the worst happens. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
And the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, in the wake of the pandemic, have you decided to rearrange your friendscape? We'll explain, then we'll take your calls. Then Boston Pride is facing pushback for its lack of diversity and inclusion. With no black members in its leadership, it came under fire last year for what activists say was its weak support for Black Lives Matter. Now a number of LGBTQ groups are boycotting Pride and organizing alternative events, bringing some mayoral candidates along. Media maven Sue O'Connell will join us to discuss.
Intelligence officials say they found no evidence that the unexplained aerial crafts documented by Navy pilots in recent years are alien spacecraft. But they're not saying they're not alien spacecraft either. A new report raises more questions than answers on what we're seeing when we see UFOs. GBH's Emily Rooney will discuss this and more. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
I won't bore people to tears and talk about how great the weekend weather is going to be, but oh my God, I'm so psyched.
No, nice and hot.
So now that we're coming out of the pandemic and we no longer have coronavirus restrictions to deflect or distract us from being social, are you reassessing your relationships? There's this counseling professor, her name is Suzanne Deggs, I hope I pronounce it White. Pronounce it correctly, at Northern Illinois University. She has a name for how we value our friendship. She calls it Friendscape, where people inhabit the foreground, the middle ground, or the background, depending on how much time and emotional energy you choose to invest in them. We're asking you, are you ready to do some friendscaping? Did the pandemic put your friendships to the test? Did it reconnect you with friends who'd fallen away? Are you rethinking who you want to spend time with and how post-pandemic? 877-301-8970. If you look at your friendscape, Marjorie, does it need weeding or pruning or whatever?
Yeah.
And by the way, yesterday we talked about, you know, what were the habits or experiences, whatever, that you embraced during the pandemic? You're going to take them with you. This is the human side of that same discussion. Are you doing some friendscaping? A term I never use, but I like it, actually. It fits sort of the notion about whether you're reassessing relationships now that you return to the real world. The number is 877-301-8970. Are you or what?
No, I'm not. I have the same friends now I had before, but there's a lot of fascinating stuff about friendship that was written in this New York Times piece by Kate Murphy, talking about how you have to spend daily or weekly time with friends to maintain your foreground friends, as she calls them. So that can be no more than 4 to 6 friends. And she also talks about you got to think about how your interactions with your friends make you feel, that depressed friends make it more likely you'll be depressed. Overweight friends make it more likely you'll become overweight. People who drink a lot, friends will make you drink. I mean, it's a fascinating piece about friendship's impact. And friends are supposed to make you feel better about yourself. Well, that's not always true, right? Sometimes you have little tense moments with friends like you do with siblings or cousins or something like that.
No, but I think the writers mean overall that you should gain enjoyment from these relationships. You know what I also learned from this piece? Maybe I should have known this before. This is quoting some guy from Yale who's written a book called Apollo's Arrow. We take it for granted, but having friends is exceedingly rare in the animal kingdom. And he says, other than chimps, elephants, and dolphins, humans are about it. So we want to know if you're doing any friendscaping, reassessing of friendships, relationships, either. Because, I mean, even I, who, as you know, I'm not the most social of people. I mean, I sort of did a life reassessment kind of thing. When you live through 50, you live through 14 months of this when you're seeing people dying around you. I mean, not intimately in my case, but you read about it, you hear about it. You like to think you're showing some empathy for people who are doing great suffering. You're scared a lot of the time. You reassess your relationships with other human beings. I am not exactly a friend-heavy kind of person.
Yeah, but you know something?
The 4 to 6 people thing in that thing, I don't think I've had four people combined who have
since I've known you, which is a long time now, in the last couple of years, you've added a very close friend.
Or a couple
before,
of them, yeah.
Before the pandemic, or maybe a couple of them, okay. A
couple, yeah.
And it, at least the one I know about is still a very close friend post-pandemic. So you haven't shed anybody as far as I know, have you?
Well, I've been in a constant shedding process my whole life, actually. So I pick up and shed depending on what the experience is. But you do. I hate to sound sappy, but you really do look at your life, don't you? I mean, unless you were totally out of it for the last 14 months, you reassess everything you're doing, how you spend your time.
Yeah.
You know, your sort of work-life balance kind of thing, which is part of the reason it's not just these, you know, the supplemental unemployment thing that everybody is obsessed with about why workers are so hard to find. A lot of people have said, well, I actually like spending time with my kids or relaxing or being with my spouse or partner or something. And so you do a lot of reassessing. And I am guessing that every single person who calls us in the next few minutes is going to say, whether consciously or otherwise, and it may not be conscious, that they have done a little friendscaping over the past few months, particularly as we come out of it. Don't you love the word?
I love the phrase, friendscaping. Yeah, it's great.
877-301-8970 is our
You know what
phone
I think,
number.
Too? I mean, this is a fairly obvious thought, Margie, but why not say it anyway?
Why not?
That stage of life with friendships is such a big deal. You know how when your kids were little, you were friends with all the other parents that were in your kids' elementary school or in your kids' high school, and sometimes you stay with those friends, but oftentimes you don't, because what you had in common was your children and, you know, not really anything else. And then as you get older, you have to reassess whether the friends that you have who've kind of gone off the rails a bit in your estimation, or the family members, do you stick with them? I mean, this is the classic political thing, you know, the Trumpsters versus the non-Trumpsters. Do you stick with those people, family members or friends, or family members are often close friends, even if you can't talk a lot about a lot of things because of the politics, or if you disagreed about the pandemic?
Well, I don't think it's just politics. I mean, it's sort of like, what's her name? It's a spark joy kind of thing. If she or he doesn't spark joy, I mean, I think that's what the point of this story
is. It
is,
but
dump
you,
it.
But do you jettison those people who've been friends with you for a long time? Because in some instances with them, you can have joy, but it's very fraught because of people's lack of seriousness.
You don't have to jettison. I were just describing this friendscaping concept that this person, I guess, came up with.
Right.
Is there's foreground, there's middle ground, or background. So they become background people. By the way, you, I should say, unlike me, I don't think I have one person from, you know, K through 12, college, law school, not one with whom I'm in touch. You're in touch with some people you grew up with to this day, aren't you?
Oh, a lot of them.
I know you are.
Yeah, a lot of them that I was like a baby with. And friends from my high school in Fall River. Yeah, I'm still friends with a lot of people I grew up with.
So we want to know if you're doing any friend. I'm sorry, what?
They're the ones that know you best. You know, they know you back when you were really
honest. In any case, we're doing a friendscaping discussion, having borrowed the term from this professor, Suzanne Degas-White. We guess her name is from Northern Illinois University. Let's start in Providence with Caitlin. Caitlin, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, so I think something that's related to this topic is the way that social media forces us to keep in touch with people that otherwise we wouldn't really keep in touch with. So we have these very weak ties. So something that I found, I got off of Facebook and Instagram in November because I knew the election was going to be a nightmare and I just didn't want to deal with it, haven't gone back. But what I found is that since I've been off of social media, in a way it has strengthened certain friendships, because, you know, it forces certain people to actually make the effort to reach out to you, and vice versa. I've made more of an effort to keep in touch with certain people while also getting rid of all of those sort of nebulous ties that I really didn't need in the first place.
Boy, that is really grown up and I think really wise. Caitlin, thank you for sharing your personal decision making with us. We appreciate it.
Well, it saves a lot of time getting off Facebook. You know, you don't have to look at all these pictures you really don't want to look at, or wish happy birthday to people you haven't talked to in 30 years, that kind of stuff, you know. Facebook's like right down the drain, it seems to me. Let's go. 877-301-8970 is the number. We're talking about reassessing your friendship, friendscaping. It's kind of a weird term. Like, you maybe shave a little bit of the corners off your friends.
That's what it is, But the reason I think you're uncomfortable with this topic is because you find it a little cold. And a little, you know, it's sort of like moving people to the background from the foreground. Even if you want them in the background, you are so kind to people for the most part. I know you hate when I say that. It is true. Stop with this.
Okay.
You are. You're a really kind person.
Compared to you, Jim. Compared to you.
Okay, fine. Everything is comparative, isn't it? And so you're a really kind person, and you don't want anybody to think that you're moving him to the background. But didn't, again, you know, you haven't commented on this. Didn't the pandemic make you think a little bit more about...
Yes, and it made a lot of friendships really harder because of the different perspectives on the pandemic and testing and vaccines and Trump and everything else. We're talking about how your relationship has changed over the year. If you're ready to reprioritize whom you know and how you spend your time with them, that conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about friendscaping, which is a term neither Marjorie or I ever heard of before. Basically, assessing your human relationships, your friend relationships post-pandemic, about whether or not you sort of had an epiphany. What are the kinds of people? Who are the people I want to spend time with? Who are they not? And the notion of this friendscaping is you consciously decide and you keep dealing with it, I guess, you know, regularly assessing it. Which of your friends should be in the foreground, middle ground, or background of your life? And that's it. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Smithfield, Rhode Island, where Kate is on the phone. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Good. I called in as soon as I heard this because I inadvertently have done a lot of friendscaping over the last year or so. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because of the high level of stress everybody's been under, but I just feel like, I was hoping to actually be more connected with friends, but I just found that they were actually using me to vent and unload on instead and forgetting that, like, I'm also probably experiencing stress too. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, I decided to set some limits and boundaries with friends and unfortunately might feel a little bit more isolated, but at the same time just felt like I was also being used.
Yeah, that's a very good point where people are telling you endlessly about their problems and don't really want to hear about yours. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, it is a tough one because you want to connect, but you feel almost... the word I keep using is used.
I mean, as hard as that is, though, Kate, don't you feel good about it in a way? That you're going through this reassessment kind of thing?
I do, because it's made me realize that, you know, I'm putting myself first. And although, you know, I've always kind of prided myself on being a good listener to people and friends, at the same time, my emotions are important, too. And if I feel bad when I get off of the phone with these people, then I'm not going to, you know, keep allowing that.
Two really grown-up people in a row. Kate, I think that's great, and I know it's hard, but I think it's great what you're doing. Thanks for sharing that with us. 877-301-8970.
Pamela says that she drove people away with her views on COVID and Trump, and she has these lifelong friends, but her peripheral friends, because of these matters, she just was talking with another friend about whether it's worth it to keep people you don't respect and who don't really respect you in your friend group.
Well, you know, on that note, by the way, and this what you said about the Trumpism and those divides and that sort of thing. I mean, weren't you a lot more tolerant of spending time and emotional energy with people who drove you nuts pre-pandemic? And don't you feel as a result of this 15 months, I only have so many hours in my life to deal with things. I want to deal with things that make me feel better or good or happy or something, you know.
You don't want to deal with somebody with a friend getting into a fight about mask wearing. It's just not very much fun. Art from West Bridgewater says, "Of course, Marjorie isn't pandemic friendscaping. She's a normal human being." I just hope this writer did not get any government funds to research this junk. So Art is unimpressed by the whole friendscaping concept.
Well, I have to say,
concept.
The one place I agree with Art is when you do hear some of these academic positions and what people are studying, you do hope that they are not federally funded. I'm with you on that.
You know, Art. I do have a friend that she calls herself a people collector, and she is. She's got so many friends, and she talks about how the time she invests every week in keeping those friendships going.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's a couple of hours.
Well, that's what this article says. You have to devote some time to this.
Phone calling.
Like you devote time to anything else.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's what, you know, people get busy. They feel like they don't have time for friends between their job and their kids and blah, 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 blah.
Well, you know how you can save time, though? You might share this with her.
Oh.
This is a motto. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. We borrowed from one of the great cartoonists of all time. How about never? Is never good for you? I mean, that isn't that... Isn't that the response? Do you have time to get the, whatever?
Don't forget, Jim, you don't make eye contact. That's another good strategy.
Who did I learn that from, by the way?
John Kerry.
John Kerry told me that. He may be upset about it. He told me at an airport in Denver right after he lost the presidential election. I said to him, how do you walk through an airport without having to talk to everybody? He says, no eye contact.
That's
Dave in Brookline, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So you had a couple of adult calls there. I don't know if I'm going to rise to that level. But, so my wife and I got separated last July, and I am not from the Boston area, though she is. So the bulk of the people I hung out with were her friends.
Oh.
And so as you can now imagine, I'm taking a big pass on that. So I have one close friend in the Boston area and two better than average acquaintances. And so I've been thinking, oh, well, you know, I'll get on, you know, Hinge or Tinder or whatever. Man, the last thing I want to do is, like, meet people and go on dates. So I don't really know what to do. And I just think that for people like me, I'm sure there are lots of people who got separated during the pandemic. I kind of don't know what to do.
Well, can I make a selfish suggestion? And I don't know when this is. One of the great sets of events where everybody who goes tell us they made friends are GBH events, which are as spectacular as – and I'm serious, by the way.
I
mean, like,
you know,
the wine and wine tasting thing in the fall. I don't know when they're coming back in a non-virtual kind of way, but what's your advice, Marjorie? You have many more friends than I do.
I'm not an expert on this, Dave, but I know friends of mine have done these things where, like, they join the Appalachian Mountain Club, or they do. There's these websites that talk about getting together to do things you like to do. I wish I knew what they were, though. I apologize.
What, Dave?
I'm a distance runner, so I'll join a running group.
Oh,
that's
a great
thing.
Group. Do you know? Are you from Brookline?
Not originally, but
Live here now. Because I know about that. They have one that goes out of Marathon Sports on Beacon Street. They run out of there every week, and they have a great one over in South Boston that runs out of the L Street Bathhouse, where people are – and they're all different levels, people that are fast, people that are slow. Those are great – that's
Dave,
a great idea.
Don't go away, Dave. One of our colleagues in the control room said the ultimate – solution, get a dog. I mean, that is really, I'm serious. You know what another thing is, by the way? Or you can rent a little kid. When my parents were divorced, this is totally true. My father would walk, it was like the only time he was really nice to me. He'd walk me along the beach hand in hand when I was a little tiny kid because he thought it attracted women. So,
but I
forget the kid
magnet.
Thing. Dog, I think, is the
dog. That's right. Then you can go to the dog park. There's a lot of mixing and maxing going on in the dog park.
Seriously, but I'm not joking. Our colleagues are right. Dog is the
except
answer.
But the dog is very time consuming, though.
Well, you know,
especially
say,
if Dave,
Dave
is
didn't
living
say
alone.
He didn't have time.
Well,
Dave,
I don't know. Do you have time
you have
for dog, Dave?
Dave, you have friendship from the dog, and the dog helps you get other friends. Are you going to do that or not?
Well, I can't do that, but I have two little kids, so can I take them to the park and, like, hit on the single moms? Or
absolutely.
That is exactly what my father did if he was still here. So good luck to you with that effort, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.
Much for the call. The dog idea is brilliant, by the way.
You know, that is true. When I used to take my kids to the park, you see a guy there with a couple of kids, you always think, what's going on? Where's the wife? Where's the mother? Is he single? Is he married? Is he divorced? What's the deal? You know, or is he just a great dad? He's a great dad taking the kids to the park. You know, I think that the children are real magnets.
Attractors. Hey, Cheryl, we only have 45 seconds, but it's yours. Please make it quick. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have belonged to a writer's group for many years, and we would meet, pre-pandemic, we would meet monthly. We go, we discuss our writing, then we go out for dinner and drink.
Oh, nice.
And since the pandemic, we had been meeting weekly via Zoom, and we've all just grown so much closer to each other, and it's become a really important group of friends for all of us.
Yeah.
And last week, for the first time in 14 months, we actually ate out at a restaurant.
Wow. Oh,
and
that's
it was
great.
Quite exciting. Yes. Yeah.
That's, you can hear it in your voice too, Cheryl. I think it's great. Thanks for sharing that with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, the Zoom groups have worked out better than you'd think they were.
For some,
and
they
a
have,
lot of
for
people
some,
say yeah. Zoom therapy has worked out very well too. Anyway, up next, it is time. Is it time? Is it time? That's correct, Marjorie. For Boston Pride to turn its rainbow flag into a rainbow coalition. Sue O'Connell joins us to talk about the diversity problem at Pride and more. She's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Join us online to take on the social norms and abnormalities of the day as media maven Sue O'Connell. Sue is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. She's NECN's political commentator and explainer-in-chief, and she is now with us. Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Good day. Happy Pride.
And to you.
Well, happy Pride, I guess, but all I've been reading is stories about dissension in the ranks, both here in Boston and in New York City, and maybe even around
the world.
Country.
In the world, Marjorie. Yeah. In the world.
So,
you know,
what's happening?
Go ahead. Well, first, I need to do one of these disclosures that I am so enmeshed in this issue, I have absolutely no objectivity.
Okay.
So I'm not talking about this as a journalist. I'm talking about this as someone who has talked to the candidates and the committees. NBC and the NECN is a corporate sponsor, media sponsor of Boston Pride. Bay Windows is not. I mean, I'm completely enmeshed in this. So if anyone's going to send me a Twitter message saying that was totally not objective, no kidding, can't be on this one. So, you know, look at the Pride with a capital P, both here in Boston and around the world, has been an exceptional success story of triumph over tragedy, right? This what started as a backlash, a riot, an uprising, whichever word you want to use, at the Stonewall Inn in New York City some 50 years ago, 50 plus years ago, where mostly black and brown people, mostly drag queens, mostly men and women who could not be out in public, fought back against a police raid, which was probably orchestrated because the mafia hadn't paid the cops off. And this was, you know, and they just had it. And there was an uprising against it. And from that, it wasn't exactly the birth of the movement, but it pushed the movement into the foreground. And now it's a big event where banks and kindergartens and accountants and everybody wants to march in it. And you can't look at an ad this month without seeing a rainbow in it. Like, it's like the Target has a rainbow clothing line for Pride, right? So we have had this incredible assimilation and success, and therein lies the problem, because every single year that there's been a Pride, there have been dissenters, and there have been people who have been against the direction the Pride organizers are going through. When I worked at the Boston Phoenix in the early 1990s, we were a media sponsor, and I was in charge of selling the Pride guide, and I sold an ad to Absolut Vodka, and some people were really upset that I was, you know, making Pride too corporate back in the early 90s, right? So this continues on, but right now, at this moment in time for Boston, the Boston Pride Committee, which is volunteer and who have this enormous task of organizing the parade, which is going to be in October this year, as well as all the other events, is under legitimate fire because they have not been as diversified as they should have been, not just this year, but over the past 10 years. They haven't had someone of color on the board. They have, at any given turn, when they have had the opportunity to welcome BLM into the Pride family, not just this year, but years prior, to integrate Black Pride into the big Pride organization, they have done a terrible job. And this is the year that they're paying the price for that. And it's a challenge. They have done a lot of things. They've done listening. They're trying to integrate the board. They're trying to diversify the board. They are being very active over the past 12 months. But the reality is, it's hard for them to catch up. And the trans community is also one of the communities that they feel that they have been excluded. So it's a tough spot for the Pride Committee to be in. I'm hoping that they'll be able to find their way through this. But there's a local organization that you know, we had a forum, a mayoral forum scheduled for
this coming
Monday that NBC, NECN, and Telemundo were sponsoring with the Pride Committee. And another organization, the trans organization, decided that they were going to call the candidates to boycott it. They decided in a flex move to schedule their forum on the same night that our forum was scheduled. I said we should just move the forum. They can have that space. And we moved the forum. Our forum is actually going to be on the 14th. But it's an important conversation to have because who Pride represents and what Pride does should be something that represents the LGBTQIA plus community of today. And what they're demanding, I think, are legitimate demands. But again, it's an issue that has gone on for many years. You remember Bedgate? Remember?
Marjorie,
no. I think you wrote a column about this in the Boston Herald some 15 years ago or so. There were the Lesbian Avengers had a pride float.
I do remember this. Yeah.
Behind Mayor Menino. Mayor Menino. Right. So there was the conversation of why are we eliminating sex from the Pride Parade, right? Why does the Pride Committee not have LGBTQ in their name? Why are they Boston Pride and not Boston LGBTQ Pride? Why do the fetish people have to march at the end of the parade instead of at the beginning of the parade when they've been marching in the parade for 50 years, right? So these are the conversations that are happening. I think it's because of the pandemic and because things are virtual and things are paused, it's a great opportunity to really air these out. But again, we've been having these conversations every year in the Pride Committee. They're sort of now broken through because the community is important enough that all the candidates for mayor want to make sure they talk to us, which is success. So we need to make sure that it's an inclusive success.
So what about New York City where they're banning the gay cops?
Yeah, so New York has also had this struggle, and it's been going on for a few years. They actually have a couple of prides. They have the Heritage Pride, and then they have new prides that have popped up that are trying to keep the spirit of the original pride. And their committee decided that they were going to ban the LGBTQ police organizations from marching in the parade in response to, the feelings across the country of police violence, police overstep, and the origins of the parade, you know, the origins of the movement are from a police raid, right? So are we in a spot where we think the police are our friends and should be included, or are they part of the challenge? Now, of course, you know, as I've said a million times on your show, I'm an institutionalist, and I think the fact that we have LGBTQ liaisons, that we have the police departments who are openly soliciting for LGBTQ top cops to be in on the force. I have many friends who are cops who are queer. So it's up to New York to try and figure out how they're going to do this. But again, it's difficult for them because you've got the heavy hand of the institutional pride who's been running the parade and running the organization. And then people who are the grassroots, I think they're called Reclaim Pride and another organization, I think the acronym is STAR, who are trying to make sure that they don't want that to happen. But again, these are all very valuable conversations for us to be having to make sure that pride, however it looks and however it looks in each city or state, represents the values and the members of the community. And I'll also add, I think of the 80% of the people who want to engage in pride or parades and floats and parties have no idea that this is going on, right? This is one of those other things. They want to come into the city, have a great dinner, go to a parade. I mean, I've been complaining for years that it's not political enough. Like, people come into the city, they're one gay event, and they don't sign up for anything. They don't hear any conversations from politicians or elected officials. I mean, that's always my criticism of Pride. So Pride will go on, and people are still saying happy Pride. And I think it's a good time to have the conversation.
Well, I'm glad it's not a sore spot with you, Sue. That's really good. It's, God.
My kid's about to donate $10 so that she doesn't have to hear me ranting about this around the house. Because every time it's Pride, she's just like, oh, no, it's Pride. She's going to be yelling on the phone again. Oh, no.
I'm bad here. Where are my kids? Nobody's donating here.
Well, you have a couple more days, I think, left. I would call all your children if I were you. Sue, we have limited time today because of the pledge. And we were going to talk to you about this wildly successful needle exchange program in Indiana that actually was started by Mike Pence when he was Pence was there. Am I not right when he was
2015?
Governor. And then, of course, it's being rescinded in the new political era, even though it apparently saved hundreds of lives. But rather than talking about that, maybe we can do that after we come back. Did you guys follow what Mike Pence made one of his first post-election appearances? Saying, you know, instead of confronting the issue about the assault on democracy head on, says, you know, humorously, the president, meaning Trump, and I may have some differences about what happened on January 6th. Yeah, you mean the January 6th insurrection when people were saying, hang Mike Pence? Is that what you mean? And then it goes on to say, I don't mean to vent, and I don't want to be in a bad mood. It's a beautiful Friday. Is he then goes on to criticize the infrastructure bill, saying that the Democrats are trying to pull a fast one. It's really about climate change. The implication to me being, boy, what a fraud. Who wants to deal with climate change? We want to deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. And can I add one more thing to this? And then
yes,
I'll.
And the myth of the left wing myth of systemic racism. That really got
There's no such thing as systemic racism. But you know what? We got to take a break. And you know what we can do when we come back? We can discuss
what can we
him.
Do, Jim?
But I want to discuss one other politician, a young Bush who is running for Texas Attorney General, who aggravated me almost as much as Mike Pence did. Okay. Is that okay?
Yep. Your daughter's very grateful. You're going to be able to talk about all these things when we come
all
back.
All my grievances. Talk to them exactly.
At home.
Thank you.
We're talking to media maven Sue O'Connell. That conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and media maven Sue O'Connell.
So, Sue O'Connell, what do you want to talk about, Jim? You want to talk about George P. Bush?
I want to talk about George. Can I tell the story here?
George P. Bush,
I don't know if you read this, people out there.
It's really...
Who's 45, by the way? When did he turn 45?
I don't know.
That's the other part of the story that's shocking to me.
Okay, so let me just tell the story and get the reaction from both of you. George P. Bush, he is the son of the former Governor Bush of Florida, who was ridiculed mercilessly by Donald Trump.
Correct.
He is the nephew of the former president, George Bush, the younger, George W. Bush, who we have mixed feelings about. I think we have to be honest. And his grandfather is George H.W. Bush, who people feel pretty good about. He announces his run for Texas Attorney General. What did he say about his father? Nothing. What did he say about his uncle? Nothing. What did he say about his grandfather? Nothing. All of which is fine. Who does he praise, Marjorie, in his campaign announcement?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump. Sue O'Connell, do you have a comment on this young man who wants to be the Attorney General of Texas?
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about the friendscaping and getting rid of people who, you know, as we emerge from the pandemic, don't work for us. And I think we need to look at the Republicans. I mean, Pence isn't quite ready to cut out Trump, right?
Apparently.
He had a very troubled, you know, relationship with Trump there toward the end. And now you've got this lovely George P. Bush, who, you know, every single member of his family cannot stand, I think it's safe to say, cannot stand Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump did not go to his grandfather's funeral.
I forgot about that.
You know, they organized things so that he wouldn't be there. Yet, you know, he sees his ticket forward, not with the established Bush family and the establishment of the Republican Party, but with Donald Trump. So, you know, family issues aside and loyalties aside, it's troubling, I think, if you're a Republican to look at this and see that this young upstart of the next generation of the Bush family is choosing to hitch his wagon to Trump rather than to lean into the establishment. And I think that this speaks also to the Cheney family issues that are going on, where, you know, you've got the Cheneys again, like the Bushes and like the McCains, being cut out of what the future of the Republican Party seems to be. So, I mean, look, I always worry about saying that someone is being an elected official or a candidate is being a sociopath or betraying their family to do things, because I think at some point they're all doing something that isn't exactly what they want to do. But I think this is troubling for the mainstream Republican Party that he continues to hitch his ride to Trump.
You know, I turned on CNN late last night because I was busy, and there was a police officer, one of the Capitol police officers, who'd been severely injured on January 6th.
Oh, my God. Was that moving?
Yes. And he also was an Iraq war veteran. And he spoke about how disappointed he was that there was not going to be an investigation of January 6th. But he said something that really struck me. He said, you know, these politicians aren't willing to do what they ask the police officers and, mm-hmm. and military men and women to do, which is sacrifice for something bigger than themselves. They won't even sacrifice for their job, even though most of these Congress people are going to be fine if they lose, you know, the next election. And it just struck me how really cowardly mm-hmm. so many of these Republicans who know better have become. And you see somebody like and you just think, there's a real hero. This guy fought off this mob on January 6th, was severely injured. He served and he fought in Iraq, and he was not American-born either. He had a heavy accent. I'm not sure. I came in late. Do you know where he was from?
No,
Jim?
But I know that he kissed his son when he went home.
Yeah.
And then I said, I've got to go back to work. And his wife was saying, don't do it. It's too dangerous. He said, I have an obligation to go back to work. He goes back to work, and then he talks about how the members of Congress don't give a damn about these people.
No integrity. It's just really...
Yeah. What I can't understand about the Republicans is I think that there's a path forward for them to wall off Trump, right? I think that there's a way that they could say, this arm of the party is not us. And if they all took a step together, if they all took a step toward the Cheneys of the world, God, listen to me say that, I think that they could come out of this Trump era stronger than they went into it. And that's what I don't understand about this.
You know, can I get back to George P. Bush? You guys are talking about, you know, condemning him because he's embracing Trump, and that's fine. I wasn't even talking about the politics of this.
It's his father.
You know, and a friend of mine just texted me this. In addition to the fact that he belittled George P. Bush's father and his uncle, and you mentioned the thing about the funeral with his grandfather. I forgot about this till a friend just sent this to me. Donald Trump, you know, Jeb Bush, his father, is married to his mother, who came to this country legally from Mexico. Her name is Columbia. Donald Trump retweeted a tweet from this guy, Rob Helbrine, which said Jeb Bush has to like the Mexican illegals because of his wife. So this is what, and ultimately Trump deleted it. This is what Donald Trump said about his damn mother, his mother. And he praises effusively Donald Trump. So to me, it's not about the politics of Trump. If you want to embrace it, that's your business. It is about what kind of integrity does a human being have? You know, it's sort of like, it's like Ted Cruz. By the way, your father killed JFK and your wife is ugly, which gives an opportunity for Ted Cruz to say Donald Trump is the greatest president. What is wrong with that? How do these people sleep with themselves?
But this is also, again, I feel like I'm on the Cheney bus today. But remember, Mary Cheney was an openly lesbian human being, yeah. And her sister, you know, Liz Cheney was working against LGBTQ rights.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean,
to their wedding.
But and sat next to them, you know, at her dad swearing in. But, you know, the issue here for me, again, because I expect them to be hypocrites, is why can't they find a different path to not have to do this with Trump? That's the part that's really completely befuddling to me. That are the numbers of voters that the Trump base will actually get to come out and vote, or is the Trump attacking you, is that cost so high, or are those votes so valuable that this is what you have to do? I don't know the answer to that, but it's just astonishing to me that they're choosing this.
And this is the guy they want to fall on their sword for. That's the part that kills me too.
Another upbeat discussion.
Happy Pride.
Very upbeat.
Happy Pride to you. Happy Pride to you, Sue O'Connell. Good to talk to you.
Media Maven Sue O'Connell is first and foremost, of course, a media maven. She's also a BPR contributor. She joins us every week. She's co-publisher as well of Bay Windows and the South End News, NECN's political commentator and explainer-in-chief. Coming up, Emily Rooney is here for her famous list of fixations and fulminations. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Emily Rooney joins us with her famous list of fixations and fulminations. Plus, she'll talk about that incredible Father Swan. Then Yamiche Alcindor is Washington Week's new moderator. The PBS NewsHour White House correspondent has been a stalwart presence in the briefing room, often putting her at odds with former President Donald Trump and the right-wing media. She'll join us to discuss her first few weeks on PBS's Weekly News magazine, and now she's vowed to bring her whole self to the role.
Black woman helped send Joe Biden to the White House. Now he's asking the black women in his cabinet, Marsha Fudge, Susan Rice, and Kamala Harris, to lead the effort on voting rights. Is the move an acknowledgement of black women's historic role in fighting for democracy? Callie Crossey of GBH will discuss that more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. GBH. Hello again, Jim.
What were you just doing? What were you doing there?
Actually, I hurt my arm, and I was seeing to see if my arm hurt less after I was diligently doing my physical therapy exercises, Jim.
Okay, then.
Joining us
for a famous list of assertions and aggravations and much more is Emily Rooney. Emily is host of Beat the Press, which you can catch Friday nights right here on GBH2. That would be at 7 o'clock. Hello.
Hey,
Emily
Jim.
Rooney.
Hey, Marjorie. I like that. Assertions and aggravations.
Yeah.
Assertions and aggravations. That's a good one.
I think it's mostly the latter, but whatever.
Well, I don't know what to make of this, what you think about this, but I'm really into this whole thing.
Yep.
First, I'm going to play some sound. Barack Obama was on James Corden's late night show, and he's talking about all these UFOs. 60 Minutes did it a few weeks ago, and there's been a lot of talk about these UFOs. Here's Obama talking about them.
What is true? And I'm actually being serious here, is that there's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are. We can't explain how they moved, their trajectory. They did not have an easily explainable pattern.
No. When you watch this latest one, as I'm sure you did, Emily, remember how it like turned sideways, turned around? It seemed to be just kind of suspended, defying the laws of gravity.
I just want to know,
what do you make?
Why none of these, you know, all these, there was a piece in the paper yesterday about some guy who saw a UFO. They're always exactly the same. They're saucers and they hover. How come they don't land and say, hey, Jim, hey, Marge, you know, what's it like down here? Anyway, it's like, anyway, is there anything better than a good UFO story?
I love them. It's wonderful.
This is the perfect time of year for it. It's warm. You can go outside, find something in the sky that you don't know what it is. It's like,
so what do you think
I can't complain about it. Are they aliens? I'm a big science believer, so I am supposing that there is some kind of scientific explanation for what they are, but I don't know what they are.
I'm fine
with any kind of speculation anybody has about it.
Well, first of all, you shouldn't say, Marjorie, what this is. This is not just another UFO good discussion because Obama said something to Corden. Intelligence officials of the government are going to be testifying later this month.
Yeah, but they've already come out and said that they have no, you know, they have found no evidence that any kind of aerial phenomenon witnessed by Navy pilots or alien spacecraft.
Wait. That's not fair. They said that, but the sentence continues and says, but we have no proof that they are not.
Yeah.
Well, and in light of the fact that they are
no
affirming,
evidence that there are.
Right.
But we could say this about a lot of phenomena that people believe in.
But if if Obama,
a
former president of the United States, and these intelligence people are basically saying, these Navy guys in particular, I assume some Navy women too.
These young pilots, you could hear their voices.
Navy pilots are not crazy. They are seeing something. There are only two explanations, it seems to me. One explanation is this is an alien thing. The other explanation, which in some ways is more scary, I would argue, is these same analysts suggest it may be China or Russia with what they're calling this hypersonic.
Right.
I looked it up. I didn't know what it meant. Five times the speed of sound. Hypersonic technology, which if that is what it is, that means they are way ahead of us in pretty critical technology.
Seems more plausible to me, Emily. Yeah.
Aren't the intelligence people saying it's likely one of those two things?
I didn't read it that way.
Oh, I did.
I read it that they're not going to have it. It's going to be totally inconclusive. Even after these hearings.
Why is some of this stuff classified if they don't know more than they're telling us?
Why is anything classified, Jim?
Well, that's a good
question. Let's really get down to it. Why can't we see executions? I mean, well, come on.
Let's not change the subject here.
I know, but you know what I mean. It's
I want to talk about why, Emily, you describe yourself as a big science person.
She
you are aware, of course, that we are one little teeny tiny planet.
Yes.
It's
very arrogant of us to assume.
Teeny tiny solar system in the middle of a galaxy that is joined by how many other galaxies are there? Millions?
A lot of them.
So why in the world would we think, no pun intended,
I agree. That's a very arrogant assumption. However, if these aliens have been hovering over people and, you know, Roswell and all that, they would come out. And
why would
we would
out?
Know. Of course they would. We would know.
They
yes,
know
we
what
would.
We do. We'd blow them up.
No.
Why would they come out?
Why would we blow them up?
Can
because
I tell you something?
We want to talk to them.
Excuse
why would
me,
we
you
want
two.
To talk?
I've had
and
some
by the way, why do all the aliens look exactly the same?
I've had some mid-level managers who I was convinced were from another planet. No, but all seriousness, you know, when I don't mean this to be... To keep something going in a phony fashion. When people say, why haven't they landed? Why aren't they? Who the hell knows if they've
exactly.
landed?
How
exactly. do you know that they're not part of this civilization? And
yeah,
doing
but people
it in a
say
secret...
they were kidnapped and taken away for experiment.
Come on. That's not what they say, Emily. They always say the same thing.
Here we go.
You know what it is, Jim?
Yeah, I do.
They were beamed up and
probed. And
probed.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm suspicious of that part.
Why?
But, you know,
because
you
know,
I said, I have no problem with this.
It's
amusing. It's a way to get your mind off of other, you know, more serious things that are going on in the world. Speculate all you want. But
okay, one last thing
I'm a skeptic.
I don't mean to beat this to death, but do you not find it odd, troubling, something that the United States, assuming Obama is telling the truth, and I'm assuming he is, and that these intelligence people are, that we don't know? They're affirming that these things exist, that it's not like some gaseous thing happening in the sky. The Navy pilots saw something that appeared to be aircraft because of the way they're moving against the wind, etc. Doesn't that trouble either of you that we don't know what they are?
I mean, a lot of government secrets bother me. What's the big secret? What's going to happen if you let us know? I agree with you.
Well, because the people who say that they're from outer space are going to have their careers ruined because everybody's going to think they're a nut. Right?
But by the way, don't you think that's one of the reasons they did this report, to take the stigma away from the Navy
Yes, and the guys
pilots.
On 60 Minutes, when you saw these people, these men that were talking, these military guys in 60 Minutes, did they look like nuts to you?
No,
they didn't look
didn't.
Like nuts to me.
No.
They didn't look like people in the supermarket who were drawing pictures, you know, of the aliens. With
well,
seven
as my father
heads,
used to say, anybody who sees a ghost is likely to see another one, and anybody who sees a UFO is likely to see another one.
Fine point.
It's just something that you believe. So
Emily, for those who know you, you're not only a science person, you're an animal person. And I have to say, this guy, who obviously none of us ever heard of, Matthew Rafman, who's a graduate student or something or whatever he is, this photograph and story of this, we call it
signet.
Father Swan.
Signet,
can you tell the story, Emily?
It's a signet, isn't it? So anyway.
Sorry, okay. What happened?
He noticed, this student noticed that there was a pair of swans. And what do they have, seven, you know, little duck swanlings, whatever you call them?
Swanlings, I don't know what they're called.
No, they're signet. Isn't that
signet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, he noticed that the female wasn't doing well, and when he went back, she was kind of lazing around her nest and then was having trouble swimming. And anyway, the female swan died, and the male took over. I mean, I'm wondering if that's unusual. I wonder if that's unusual with birds, because if you really notice, like, birds of prey, they take turns in nests, like eagles and owls and all that, but I'm not positive about swans, but... It's very uplifting. Another uplifting story.
It's a great story.
Like, we have to describe the photograph. Unfortunately, this is one of the few times when radio is not the best medium, which I would argue it often is. Is there's a photograph from above. When he saw the swan, the father swan, the male swan, moving, I guess he got on his bike, tried to catch up with it, goes on a bridge, and he is luckily in the right spot to take this brilliant photograph from above. And it's a photograph of the male swan floating in the water. With the three little cygnets, if that's what they're called, the three little cygnets on its back, it appears with the male swan's feathers, wings, whatever you call them, purposely in a position to protect
to
its
make
three.
A cradle.
Or so they can stand on it.
Yeah, so they can stay in there.
Incredible?
It's a fantastic.
I love all this stuff. I'm addicted to that. Have you ever watched anything on the Dodo, which is like a video website where, like, you know, a dog adopts a deer and all these wonderful, you know, rescue stories, horses and everything else. I mean, that's my pastime when I need something uplifting.
Well, to get To get back to this, not to segue from the dodo too quickly, Emily, but I just want to get back to the swans for a second. So the little baby swans were born about a week before the mother died. They said they don't know what happened to mom. Although when Boston Animal Control came, they removed the dead swan from her nest while the father was sitting there in the nest with the cygnets tucked underneath his wings. Incredible. So that's very interesting, too, because I think the male swan must have known the mother swan was dead or else it would have been hostile toward the people from animal control. And, you know, it's kind of a neat we get men all the time who are calling that complain about how I'm always saying men never do anything around the house. Well, here's a guy who's got
one man.
one little swan is one example.
Yeah. Yeah, who's rising to the fore with four little babies or five little babies?
I thought it was more, yeah.
Before we leave this topic, Emily, you're on to something, and I hope this doesn't burst people's excitement bubble. It's still beautiful. I just looked up male black swans. I know it's not a black swan. I don't even know what a black swan is. Actually spend more time on the nests than females do, because the longer the female stays on the nest, the longer the time it is in between times that she can lay eggs or whatever these swans do. So I guess it is not that unusual for male swans to be fatherly like creatures. Having said that, it's both a beautiful story.
I wonder if he's going to follow it, you know.
Beautiful photograph. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, that's where they live, right? Down at the Esplanade, so it shouldn't be that hard to follow them around.
I've never seen a black swan today. Check it out.
I've never seen a black swan, but they're, you know, they're just beautiful swans that are black instead of white ones. Yeah.
Moving on to the other reason Emily is here.
Emily is here today.
Incomprehensible. It's out of control. How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Take it away.
So I was thinking about today, June 4th, and I was thinking, there's something about June 4th. It's something happened, and I was trying to remember what it was. So, and it's on my list. I did finally find it, but I went back and I looked at a whole bunch of things that happened on June 4th, and some of them are quite amusing. So these are all things that happened on June 4th. In 1070, Roquefort cheese was created in a cave near Roquefort, France. I love Roquefort cheese, by the way. In 1783, Joseph and Jacques Montgolfier made the first public hot air balloon flight. That was a long time ago.
Wow.
1783. 1812. Do you know what happened in 1812?
The overture.
The war.
Oh, very good, Jim. No, the Louisiana Territory was officially named the Missouri Territory.
Ooh.
June 4th, 1812. In 1876, on June 4th, the first transcontinental train called the Transcontinental Express arrived in San Francisco. It took, 24 hours, something like that.
Gosh, I wonder what the first one was like inside.
No, it was more than that. 72, yeah.
I wonder if it was luxurious or
I bet
not.
It was. I bet it was.
I bet
it was just amazing.
Not that I have any idea.
Okay. In 1899, the Boston Bean Eaters, I didn't even know there was a team. It was MLB, by the way. The Boston Bean Eaters pitcher, John Clarkson, was the first ever to throw an immaculate inning, which is three batters up, three batters down, nine pitches. That was first ever.
It's amazing.
1912, Massachusetts passed the first minimum wage law. So we were the first state in the country to ever do that, which I think is pretty amazing.
Did it say what it was in 1912?
Oh, you know, I didn't get the number. That would have been a good
thing. $7.25, same as the federal wage in 2021.
7 cents. All right, in 1919, on June 4th, U.S. Congress passed the Women's Suffrage Bill, the 19th Amendment passed.
Wow.
Yeah. In 1940, the Battle at Dunkirk ended. I was really glad I saw that movie.
That was a good
movie. I didn't know that much about it.
Me too.
It was an amazing story.
That was a really good movie. Those kids standing on the beach waiting for the Germans to come kill them.
A lot of people got wiped out. 1942, speaking of World War II, the Battle of Midway began against Japan, and that marked the turning point in the war. So that was the Battle of Midway. In 1995, on June 4th, it was the last of the Mickey Rooney shows on NBC. Do you remember that show?
Oh, my gosh. Wasn't he married seven times?
Vaguely. I mean, people always used to ask me if my father... It's like, you know, that was a stage name. Mickey Rooney wasn't even his real name.
It wasn't?
Wait. The most famous Mickey Rooney story is not his relationship or whatever with your father. The most famous is on his 89th or 90th birthday, I'm not sure where, he appeared with me live on NECN.
Oh, sorry, Jim.
He was there with his seventh.
Was he talking about being elder abuse? Remember?
He was there with his seventh or eighth wife.
Oh, my God.
And the brilliant idea that I had was that live on TV, we would bring a cake out with, let's assume he was 89, with 90 candles on it. We did it. And I don't know if you know, if you ever have a cake with that many candles on, it's literally like the towering inferno. And so Mickey Rooney, who barely knew where he was, I don't mean that disrespectfully, he was sort of into it, out of it, whatever, leans forward to blow out the candles.
Oh, no.
And it is clear to me he's going to die on my show literally at that minute. And luckily, his eighth wife or whatever she was pulled him back and whatever. But that's
that's a good one.
Thank you.
The show ended a little before that. All right. 1964 on June 4th, the Beatles began their first world tour.
Wow.
Starting in Copenhagen.
That's pretty
good. My God. That's a biggie.
In 1967 on this day was the Emmy Awards. And we remember all these shows. The winners were Mission Impossible, The Monkees, Don Knotts, and Lucille Ball.
Wow.
In 1989, the Red Sox were leading the Blue Jays 10-7.
Oh, I remember.
In the seventh inning, and they ended up losing 12-11 in 12 innings. I mean,
I missed that one.
Yeah, that was a good one. All right, so this is the one that I actually was jostling my memory. June 4th, it was the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Oh, that's right.
That happened June 4th, 1989.
Oh,
you know what happened on the June 4th? I hate to be all about me, but why not?
Why not, Jim?
That same day, Tiananmen Square, who led the single largest pro-tax rally maybe in the history of the United States?
Oh, that would be Jim Browdy.
That would
Esquire.
Be me. We had 10,000 people marching through the streets of Boston to the Democratic State Convention saying, raise our taxes. We got a half a paragraph in the Boston Globe because of Tiananmen Square.
I was in Washington. I was actually getting a headliner award watching TV in Washington,
D.C. It was just brutal.
Right, in 1990. On this day, the New York Telephone announced its 917 area code. And people may not think that's a big deal, but everyone was furious. Everybody wanted the 212 number.
Of course.
And remember when every state had its own, and there were no, like 508 or 7.
New
none
Hampshire
of that.
Had one code until 2 weeks
exactly.
ago,
so
I think
917
it was
a big deal.
Yeah.
In 1998 on this day, Terry Nichols was sentenced to life for his role in the Oklahoma bombing in 1995.
Hold on for a second. We're old enough to remember when your phone number was 5 digits when you were a kid.
No,
it was never five.
Nobody
digits.
Had 5 digits. What are you, 300
volunteer
years old?
Volunteer 8.
No, we did.
No, we didn't. It was
only,
letters.
Only
there
if
was letters
you,
at the beginning.
No,
and
within
seven.
Town. Within town, you could.
You could.
Call
you
could
dial your neighbor.
Yes,
in
with four, five
in,
digits.
Not five, four. All right, I got to go. And in 2003, Martha Stewart was indicted on securities fraud and obstruction of justice. She ended up serving 5 months in jail, as we all remember.
And I just looked up Angelina Jolie, who's born 46 years ago. What are you doing tonight?
Oh, we're doing, whether Naomi Osaka makes a good point about these press conferences.
I mean, great.
She had some other issues going there. But also, we're taking a look at whether that Wuhan lab leak story got dismissed because it was something that was floated by Trump and other people like that.
And then, excellent.
Yeah.
So, good Vanity Fair story. I'm sure you've seen that.
Oh, yeah.
On the topic. Yep. Emily, it was a pleasure. Talk to you soon. Be well. Bye.
Thank you very much, Emily. Emily Rooney joins us every Friday. You can keep up with her on Friday nights right here on GBH2 at 7 o'clock for Beat the Press. Thanks, as always, Emily, for your great list. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you about the Sky Pool. Wait to hear about this. And whether, after seeing the Sky Pool, you have any interest in taking the plunge. Listen to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Gann, Jim Browdy. After a year of living cautiously, most of us anyway, hunkering down, masking up, the world presents us with a most risk-friendly opportunity, London's Sky Pool. I assume you've seen a photograph of this thing. This is a totally transparent top and bottom made out of acrylic. I think it's 82 feet long. It stretches between two high-rise buildings, 115 feet off the ground. If you look down while you're swimming, you see the street. Well, only the residents who live at the Embassy Gardens can actually use it, which is a whole other issue. It's a universal way for us to gauge how risk-averse we really are, asking ourselves, would I swim in it? Would I even want to walk under it? We're taking your calls asking you about risk. Would you take the plunge literally and figuratively? Are you a thrill seeker? Are you someone who finds doing something risky as a fun, thrilling kind of thing? Or, like me, are you risk-averse who doesn't understand the notion of being scared out of your you-know-what to have a good time? The number is 877-301-8970. I am not swimming in the Sky Pool, even if I'm invited. Two, I am the only person involved in the show right now, listening or participating in it, who has never been and will never be on a roller coaster. I don't understand the whole concept of being scared out of your mind to have fun. Are you one of those people? I don't even know. Are you one of those people?
Well, probably a little bit more than you. But you know, I think it's almost ingrained. If you think of your children or kids that you know, it's almost like they're born thrill seekers or they're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that one kid, in my case, is my youngest kid. I mean, there is not a roller coaster big enough that she won't go on.
Really?
She even went on by herself.
And what's
she was
the
like
fun?
Eight,
can you speak for her? Why does
thrill,
she love it?
The thrill. The thrill of being upside down, being sideways and almost falling and that kind of stuff. I think I might go in this pool briefly. I don't think I want to stay there all day long just to see what it's like to look down at the bottom and see you're so far up above that. But you know, the pandemic has been interesting about risk seeking, because you
point,
see
actually.
People in your neighborhood, even though we can take masks off now outside, even though you can take masks off lots of places now, there's a real divide among people who feel liberated and those who just are too nervous to do it, even outside.
877-301-8970. Last summer or the year, whatever it was, two summers ago, I was in Canada. And I went on one of those, you know, those bridges, the kind of thing where you have to hold onto the side and the whole thing shakes you walk across that.
You were like Harrison Ford, Jim.
It's the only time I've ever done it in my whole life.
Indiana
I was
Jones.
So scared. I almost couldn't breathe. And I'm saying to myself as I'm doing it, what is the point? And I got to the other side and for like a nanosecond, I was proud of myself. But I said, why is intentionally creating colossal fear in yourself.
It's the high.
A good way to get. Well, I didn't experience the high.
Yeah, it's the, so the we thrill know if and the high and the rush.
We want to know if the sky pool is the thing for you.
I mean, you know, would you jump out of an airplane? I would
Are
not jump out of an airplane.
Me?
But I have good friends who've jumped out of airplanes and they loved it. They loved it. They thought
you're
it
one of the
just,
most. Speaking of risk,
you're really alive, as they say.
We interviewed a bunch of years ago Philip Petit. And if you don't remember his name, he is the guy who walked between the two World Trade Centers, obviously, when they existed.
Oh, my God.
I mean, and then, do you remember when the cops were on the other side and he was having such a good time? He walked back again in the other direction. Obviously, no net, no nothing, 110
no
feet high.
No net.
877-301-8970. So we're using the London Sky Pool. It's getting international attention, obviously. I think it just opened a couple of days ago. Is a fear-inducing kind of thing. And whether that kind of thing gets your blood rushing and makes you happy. And I want to understand if you're one of those people. And by the way, I think that's the majority of people, at least the majority of people I know, love this kind of thing. What is it? What exactly about fear and risk-taking? I mean, how about those people that not only climb cliffs, but they or scale cliffs with no equipment?
Yeah, forget
they
don't
only
that.
Scale cliffs because the cliff is too high to do in one day. They bring a little sleeping bag. And they sleep on this suspended from the. Oh, that'd be a fun kind of way to spend a night, huh? I mean, I just don't understand it. And maybe if I did, I would partake in these things. But I just do not. I do not get the whole.
So things. So that's the question. What differentiates those who love that kind of rush and danger and you're right in the top of the fence between life and
yes.
death and those who just want to sit in their couch.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, I'm a coward. That's the answer. That's the answer. Kristen, you are in Attleboro, and you're first on the Risk Hour here on Boston Public Radio. What's the deal?
Hi, guys.
Hi.
How are you, Tom? I was just laughing when I was listening to this. It brought me back to when my son was 3.5, and I think my daughter was about 5. My daughter's a thrill seeker, loves rides.
Yeah.
Went to Disney. He barely made the hike for Space Mountain. He stood in line for 60 minutes. We got up there, and he just had a mental breakdown.
Oh,
like,
God.
So just, we forced him in the seat and went on it, and he loved it.
Yeah, okay. That's like me. I have 3 kids, and one of them is a huge thrill seeker. The other two, not so much. So is it in the genes? I mean, what do you think is going on there, Kristen?
You know, I don't know, but he loves it after. We knew he was going to love it, but every parent, can I tell you the stink eye we were getting as this little kid, as we're forcing him, literally strapping him into the seat? It was, yeah.
So are they still like that now that they're older?
My daughter loves every ride. My son, again, we went to Six Flags on the Superman ride or yeah. one of those giant roller coasters. Again, he got in, started shaking, crying. Wanted to go off. We had to drag him onto it, and he loved it. So, again,
boy, I'll tell you were a hell of a parent there, Kristen. Kristen, thank you for your call. I hope your son isn't angry at you for it.
I mean, you often stay that way.
Huh?
If you're a thrill seeker as a kid, you're going to be a thrill seeker as a grown up.
So do you think my mother should have done what Chris? I'm serious. Should have done what Kristen did? Should have made me confront my fears? I don't even like Ferris wheels. You know what I don't like about Ferris wheels? I like when they're spinning around.
Yeah.
I don't like it when people are getting off or getting
you're
on
stuck
and you're
at the
stuck
top.
At the top. I don't. So I'm serious. Should my mother have done what Kristen
I don't
did
know.
With her son?
I'm not a shrink. I don't know. I just know what I've seen in my own life, and it seems to be you're either into it or you're not into it.
Well, her son, you think her son's probably happy with her now because her son was scared to death, and he did it, and he loved it. So I guess she made, I don't know, the right decision. I don't know. Karen Easton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Yeah, as I told your screener, not in a million years would I swim in that pool.
You are mine. And why, Karen? Explain why.
Well, I didn't realize I had a fear of height until I went with my then, well, before my husband and I were married. But anyway, climbed up the Miles Standish monument in Duxbury. You know, well, I don't know if you've ever been there. Anyway,
I know it. Like, I haven't been there.
Yeah, fire escape stairs. You know where you can see down
yeah,
to the floor.
Very nerve wracking.
I got up about, I'm going to say 9 or 10 steps, and all of a sudden I had to slow down. My knees were getting weak. I was getting sick to my stomach. I started shaking. I went 2 or 3 more steps, and I burst into tears and had to collapse on the stairs.
I'm with you.
I was so shocked. I couldn't believe it.
So, Karen, what do you think that is? What separates you and me from people who are willing to take risks and love them?
Sanity, I would say.
Well, maybe that's a good thing. Karen, thank you much for the call. I'll give you another example. When Karen mentioned heights, your son, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't he love the Empire State Building, or didn't he love the Empire State Building?
Oh, this is kind of interesting. After 9/11, he became obsessed with tall buildings. I had to buy him all these books about tall buildings and models of tall buildings. Yeah. And we went to New York City, where my sister used to live, and he and I spent 8 hours on the top of the Empire
really
State. Yes, and it was in December, and it was cold. They have a little place you can go inside. You have to be outside the whole time. He was mostly outside the whole time, transfixed by tall buildings. But he's not the one that will be on the top of the roller coaster ride. He's much more cautious.
But the point I was trying to make is when I went to the Empire State Building, or been to any of the top of any of buildings,
yep,
and maybe even the Prue years, I don't know where it was, even when you're in a building, I don't even stand near the window or the fence. Like, there used to be a fence.
Do you have a fantasy about jumping off or falling off?
I don't know what I have.
Do you get that feeling in your stomach that you're about to go over the edge?
Yeah, I'm. That's one of the reasons I spend a lot of time on my couch, by the way. It's on the ground. It's on the second floor of my house. And it's sort of, it's a comfort spot. Allie in Cambridge, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. How's it going?
Well, I think okay. What's up?
She's getting nervous just discussing this.
What else?
Of this question about why we seek thrills, I think it's because it brings us a little closer to our primal nature, and people seek that in their monotonous, you know, day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
Don't have access to it.
Yeah.
I love horror movies, and everyone always asks why I would willingly be scared, but I think it's because it's the same thing, I don't know, the same stuff that makes you laugh and makes you scream. It all comes from, like, the fight-or-flight place that we don't have access to typically on a day-to-day basis. So I think people are seeking thrills to get closer to something that we've lost touch with.
I think that's a great definition and understanding. Yeah, yeah. And like I said before, there's a rush and a high to it too, right?
Yeah, totally. It's a rush, and I think, but it serves more than just being a thrill for thrill's sake. I think it's like, we need that. I don't know. I mean, Jim, there's probably something in your life that you do that gives you a little bit of a thrill and makes you scared.
Why?
Right?
The only thing I could think, I was trying to think of what there was such a thing. I'm not crazy about blue cheese, and I tried it the other night. And so, and it was okay. It was a risk-laden effort for me, but I decided I'm just going to plow ahead and do it. Allie, I'll try to think if there is something during the break. And thank you very much for your analysis. I think Allie's is actually a pretty good one, frankly.
Okay, we are going to keep talking about this. London Sky Pool risk-taking, who does it, who doesn't, and why. If you're the kind of thrill-seeker who would take the plunge in London Sky Pool or not. Quick break. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're having a conversation that was prompted by this London sky pool. And if you haven't seen it, it's this thing, this pool. I think it just opened. It's between two high-rises in London. It is a totally see-through swimming pool, 115 feet off the ground, so that if you look down while you're swimming, you will see the street. You won't see the bottom of a pool. You will see the street, which to me is both thrilling but very scary. And I'm not about to do it.
We want to know if you're the kind of person. I have a couple of emails from thrill seekers here, Jim.
Okay, well, let me just finish the thought. If we want to know if you're the kind of person whose idea of fun is something like that, or a roller coaster, or spending the night, you know, swinging from a cliff that you were attempting to climb. The number is 877-301-8970. I'm sorry, Marjorie. Take it away.
I'm sorry. As I can't see you, that's why I'm...
I'm sorry. The screen's off. My apologies.
The screen is off. So Bill says, I would swim in the pool. In fact, my only regret would be that there's no diving board. And Mark says, I've been listening... he's a colleague of us, of ours here at GBH, actually. He says, thrill-seeking. I have been riding... Okay, he works at the same place as us, but he's a thrill seeker. I've been riding motorcycles for 35 years, jumped out of a plane for my 50th birthday, and currently am pursuing getting a glider pilot's license. Nothing makes life worth living like pushing yourself to the limits, getting the heart rate up, getting to the edge of your comfort zone, and stepping over the line. Every chance I get, I will do it.
Well, so that's almost like I feel embarrassed when I hear something like that. I mean, he put it in a way that I feel like I am the total weakling that I fear I am when it comes to, these kinds of... If I said to you, Marjorie, that an anonymous benefactor, a generous group of GBH donors, as we call them, has said they would like to give you a $2 million check if you jumped out of an airplane, would you do it?
For $2 million?
Yeah.
Yes, I would jump out of the airplane.
Would I do it? No. 877 301.
Matter of fact, I'd do it for a lot less than that. If you really want to know the truth.
Well, you're not getting the $2 million anyway. Hey, Kate in Concord.
Kate in Concord, thank you for calling.
Hey.
Hi. I wouldn't call myself a thrill seeker, but I love water, and I would fly to London if they would allow me to do laps or hang out in that pool.
Have you seen the photograph of it, Kate?
No, I'll have to go online to look at it.
It is just type in sky pool, and it'll come up. There are a million photographs. It is beautiful. So there's nothing about that that causes you any fear or anxiety?
Well, a number of years ago, I became clear on the difference between fear of falling and fear of height. Because I don't have fear of heights. I can go on a hot air balloon. I can do a lot of different things and look down. But I hate the feeling of falling.
Mm. Yeah.
And my son took up, diving and, high diving. And I really had him coach me to try and help me to do it because I wanted to kind of conquer that fear, and it was really scary. But then I have three children, and two of them always were really very fine about heights. But I have one, my daughter. Actually, when I was 7.5 months pregnant with her, I took her brother to Disney World by myself, and we did all the rides. Because it was just the two of us. And water country and going down all the slides and roller coasters. And she has always had an affinity for that. So I wonder if it's that in utero she was trained. And her daughter now is also fearless. Absolutely, physically fearless. And there's a difference between thrill-seeking for physical thrills or, really challenging yourself in other ways. Right?
That's a great point, too.
Although you might say you're a bit of a wuss with jumping out of planes, I'm sure there's any number of times where you take big risks and do things that you're a little nervous about, and then you conquer them.
Well, I hope. Don't ask me what they are, Kate.
A great point. I wonder if there's any correlation between people who take risks, physical risks, like jumping out of an airplane, or financial risks, or risks in relationships. If you're risky in every area,
don't you think there is?
I don't think there is.
But doesn't it make sense that it's a certain type of personality? I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I mean, it's a risk-taking personality, I'm assuming, is risk-taking in virtually the whole 360, don't you think?
And I also think there's something about being in control. Like, I might ride a motorcycle when I'm driving. I don't want to be sitting behind somebody in a motorcycle. I'd feel much better if I was in control.
That's a great point. Well, can I make a corollary point?
Yeah.
If I was in a hot air balloon, either operating it or as a passenger, I would not be there. Let me be clear. I'm in control or I'm not in control. By the way, one more thing about Skypool, which has nothing to do with risk aversion or fear or any of that kind of thing. Did you read the story? The first thing I read, which was disappointing, because I'm sure everybody wants, if they're going to go to London, wants to go at least look at it. Mm-hmm. I'd look at it at least. You have to live there, which is fine. However, if you read further into some of the stories, wait to hear this. They have a statutory in London. There's a statutory minimum of low income housing, affordable housing kind of thing. I don't know what the threshold is, whatever it is. If you live in these two buildings and you are loaded, you may swim in the pool. If you live in these two buildings, but you're only living there because you're a low income resident, you may not swim in the pool.
That's it.
I mean, isn't that enough reason not to swim in the pool, even if you wanted?
The chain lock fence up for you.
Do you remember, by the way, we did a show a couple of years ago off of New York. This has nothing to do with this. I'm sorry. We'll get back to you guys in a minute. About a New York Times building on the Upper West Side, a few blocks where I used to live at 81st and West End, which is Riverside, which is where I lived, where there was a separate entrance to the building for people who live there because of affordable housing regulations in New York. Is that about a despicable a thing as you've ever heard in your life?
That's pretty bad.
Zachary and JP, welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
I wanted to make a couple points, if I may.
Sure.
The first you just hinted at is about control. And so I'm an adrenaline junkie by nature. Ever since I was a little kid, I've done it. I've been skateboarding for 20 years, mountain biking, cliff jumping, rock climbing, all of it. But that being said, I don't like to fly. If I'm a passenger flying, I don't like to even be a passenger in a car. I wouldn't go in the London Sky Pool, and I don't like roller coasters. And I think all of that's because I'm relying on somebody else's mechanical invention or them doing the task well.
That's a great point.
I'm not comfortable.
Yeah.
But when it's me doing it, it's a sense of, first off, I don't think of it as like, I don't have fear of the thing. I have lots of fear of the thing. And overcoming that fear is where the adrenaline comes from, for me personally.
You know, I think that's a really important point, whether you are the person that's doing it. What does your mother think about all this, by the way, Zachary? I bet she's happy that you're doing all this stuff.
She encouraged it from a very young age.
Did she?
Scared to death. And we racked up quite a ER bill. I think I was in the ER for critical injuries probably 10 times before I was 10 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Listen, don't go away. When you started this phone call, Zachary, you said something about cliffs that you do. What's the cliff exercise you engage in?
Like jumping off a cliff into water.
Huh.
And so it's a calculated risk. And typically it starts by you go into the water and seek out if there's any rocks or debris in the water where you're about to jump. See how deep it is. Do some diving. Scope it out. And then, throw your body off of it.
You know, now that's something I might do. Something I might do, jump off into water.
I admire this guy, I'll tell you. I wish
not too high.
Hey, Zachary, thanks for the...
That was a great call.
Adrenaline junkie, that's a good...
Here's another question, too. Is it depending on what it is?
What do you mean?
Well, I just said I could jump off a pretty high cliff into water, but there's other things I couldn't certainly climb up a mountain, forget that, or rock climb or anything like that. So what's that about? I don't know. I guess because I think I'd be okay jumping into water.
Well, you know, now that you're saying that, I'm trying to think of certain, you know, different gradations. The cliff jumping into water, if I knew that the ambulance had the motor running and it was ready to go, I would seriously, and someone was ready to set the bones in my leg.
Okay, so there's no area that you're interested in.
I'm trying to think. I mean, I listened to this guy, Zachary, a minute ago, and I'm not being facetious. I wouldn't like to have all of his adrenaline junkiness, but I would like to have a piece of that.
Yeah.
But I really don't think.
You know, I'm thinking back, Jim. I suppose it's because there've been so many mishaps, like the time you tried to ride the bike.
Yeah, well, that was a problem. I mean, by the way, I know what you're thinking out there. You're saying, well, bike riding is not exactly a dangerous. The problem was, it was the first time I borrowed a bike from a friend.
The big boy bike.
Well, I think I can say who it is.
A huge bike.
This is Ed Ryan,
he's a
big
boy,
former president of the Mass Bar.
That's right.
And what he's done is he's ridden the Pan Mass Challenge, I think, every single year since Billy Starr found that maybe the first three years or something. But he's ridden it for decades, raised a ton of money, etc. He lent me his bike. It's one of those titanium bikes that weighs like, you know, an ounce or some such thing. And what I didn't know is on those kind of bikes, unlike the bikes that I had grown up riding, your feet are clamped in.
They are.
To the pedals, if you call them pedals. And so when the bike stopped for the first time, I didn't remember that my feet were clamped in. And what happens if your feet are clamped in and you stop?
You tip over. Yeah,
and you're
a long
bloodied
way to fall.
And all the little kids who were on a field trip laugh at you. And they're all like 3 feet tall. And they're all laughing uproariously, even though you're in excruciating pain. So the bike riding didn't work out for me.
Yeah. It's maybe a coordination issue. That could be it, Jim.
That could be it.
Ellen in the car. Thank you for calling.
That was a sad story, actually. Go ahead, Ellen. It's not funny, Ellen. It's very painful.
It's really funny.
What's up, Ellen?
So I'm going to do that awful thing with like both sides.
Okay.
On the one hand, I have no fear. Like, I have older siblings that used to throw me off the porch to the roof into the pool, and I laughed hysterically. Used to do like a million backhand springs off a trampoline. Could care less. But I feel like if I'm in control of something,
yes.
I get really fearful.
Yes.
But the thing about the pool, I'm not afraid of like the height. We went on the I in London, and it was awesome. I loved it.
Ellen, stop there for one second.
Explain that to people.
I've actually been on the I. That's one thing I actually loved. Explain what it is,
oh,
Ellen.
Oh, it's beautiful. So it's like a giant gondola.
Yeah.
Like a giant gondola, like that you have like a bunch of people. So you have your own little pod, and then it just kind of slowly goes around. You can see all of London.
But it's like gondola is like a Ferris wheel. It's like a glass, huge Ferris wheel kind of thing,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's like a giant, like, encased.
Right. I was okay with that. In fact, I loved it. It was beautiful. Go ahead.
It was absolutely wonderful. My husband doesn't really love heights, but he was fine with it. And
me too.
It was great. You can fit probably, it's almost like a subway car.
Mm.
It's like that big. So, but the only problem was we were in Turks over this past spring vacation, and we were at the pool, and there's a swim-up bar, and literally not a single person got out of the pool within hours. So my problem with swimming across would not be the height. It would be the urination.
Oh,
well,
God.
Ellen, that is an issue. That is a real issue. But you don't need to be in Sky Pool, as you just made that point, to be there. Ellen, thanks for the call. We actually found something, thanks to Ellen, that was, I wouldn't say exactly risk-laden, but is a little bit riskier, a little bit scarier, that I loved every minute of. And for some reason, the eye was that thing.
You know, here, Sheila just sent a thing that we both do, the very thing that lots of people are afraid of, which is public speaking.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing as physical danger, but people do get petrified. There used to be a place down the street for me, this bustling business that was all about overcoming people's fears of public speaking. So that's a very common thing.
But that's
a
totally different kind of fear, and I don't have it. You don't, but it's a totally different kind of. Is it a physical thing?
It's not a physical thing. It's a mental thing that you're going to make a fool of yourself. You're not going to be able to talk, or nothing's going to come out of your mouth, or you're going to say things wrong, or something.
But the other thing is a mental fear too, because you know what are the odds of, you know, I'm sure those things that are written every once in a while when something happens, the odds of being, you know, having dying on a roller coaster is probably smaller than dying walking across the street in Brookline, you know. So that's mental, too. In any case, I don't know what I'm trying to say. Judy and Hudson, welcome.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a different take on this.
Please.
I would not do any of those, to me, risk things. But when I recall being absolutely horrified at the guy who walked between the two Twin Towers, I did some research on it, and I found that there are theories that there's a protein in the brain that is longer in people who take risks.
Whoa.
And I thought,
really?
Well, that makes sense, because physically there are people who like diet soda and those who can taste it and think it's vile, like myself.
Me too.
And there are those who hate cilantro and those who love it. And I'm thinking, this could be totally physical, and I'm not going to call myself a coward just because I don't have that protein in my brain.
You're a genius, but, by the way. I mean, I don't even know if you're right. It makes total sense to me, and it also makes me feel less bad about myself. But isn't Judy's basic point so obvious?
Well, it also explains, like, if, as I said before, if you've got four children and two of them are risk takers from the time they're three and two of them aren't, that it's born
a different physiological thing. Right.
Yeah.
Judy, I hope you're right, and I'm going to believe you're right, even if you're not. Judy,
right.
Thanks for
your problem is
doing that.
Teeny tiny proteins in your brain, Jim. That's that's the dilemma.
I guess it is.
Okay.
Let's hope.
Coming up, we're going to talk to Yamiche Alcindor.
Great.
I can't wait about her new role as the moderator of Washington Week. Yamiche Alcindor is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie Egan. I am Jim Browdy. Just over a year ago, President Trump was holding one of his daily coronavirus briefings, and we always knew we were getting closer to the truth when he would rebuke reporters for asking what he described as nasty or stupid questions. Yamiche Alcindor often provoked that reaction from Trump. Last March, when Alcindor asked him, I think it was about why the United States was lagging behind other countries in providing coronavirus tests for their citizens, exasperated by her line of questions, Trump said, quote, you should be saying congratulations rather than asking a really snarky question. Alcindor later tweeted, quote, President Trump today at the White House said to me, be nice, don't be threatening. I'm not the first human being, woman, black person, or journalist to be told that while doing a job, my take, be steady, stay focused, remember your purpose, and always press forward. You can see Alcindor's purpose, focus, and commitment to pressing forward every Friday night. As the new moderator of Washington Week, Yamiche is also the White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, political contributor for NBC News, and MSNBC. Yamiche, congratulations on yet another concurrent assignment, and welcome to Boston
Public Radio. Thank you. Well, my whole family's from Boston except for me. My brother was even born in Boston, so I'm excited to be on.
Oh,
yes,
really?
My parents left. My parents met at Boston College.
Whoa.
Well, I hope they're all tuning in by the dozens. They listen
Large
to you.
Boston Haitian community.
Great. Hey, great. Well, I'm really excited to talk to you for a bunch of reasons. But first, just tell people, Yamiche, who may not know, I'm sure almost 90% of people do, but tell them anyway, for those who don't, what Washington Week is and what you're doing.
So Washington Week is the longest running public affairs television show. We're on PBS every Friday night. And what we're doing is really talking to the best reporters in the country about the news that's happened that week. And it's about the insurrection. It's about the commission being blocked. And it's really trying to get in the behind the scenes of power and politics. And for me, I should say my guiding light, what I hope will be my influence on the show, will also be very, very relevant to people sitting at home. So it's not just going to be about Washington politics, but it's also going to be about how those Washington politics influence other parts of this country, including, of course, Boston.
And you do something that is really outdated. I don't mean to criticize you, but you're actually nice to each other and respect each other like human beings. How hard is that, Yamiche, in 2021?
You know, for me, it's not very hard. I love the idea that we are not screaming at each other. This is not arguments on TV. What this is a calm, fresh, relevant conversation. And it's about getting the best reporters. So when you're around that table, when you turn on your TV and you see someone at our table, you know that they have the credentials to be there. They're not just telling you what they think. They're telling you what sources in the White House have told them. They're telling you what their trips to Israel, whether they just got back to, what they learned on that trip. So it's really about on-the-ground reporting that illuminates all of the things that are going on.
You know, Yamiche, I used to be a newspaper reporter and for most of my life, actually. And in one of the interviews you gave, you talked about how valuable it is to know about the lives of those who don't have a voice. And one of my pet peeves about the current media culture is so many of the so-called talking heads have never really sat in the living rooms of people that they might be writing a story about, don't see that firsthand. Talk about that, because you have been a reporter for much of your life, too.
Yes, and I really value so much people who and reporters who have done that on the ground reporting. I learned not about racism, not just in reading a textbook, but in going to Ferguson and living there for a year. I learned about all of the different struggles of people during the pandemic, not by only talking to people on Skype, which of course is what a lot of people did to be safe, but I went into communities, immigrants who were living 7 to an apartment to see what was going on. I went into Southeast Washington, D.C. to see exactly what it's like when you have no hospital, no trauma hospital anywhere near you, driving around the neighborhood to really get a sense of it. And that's what I want from all of the reporters who come to the Washington Week table, to say, what did you see this week? What did this lawmaker tell you? Of course, there's the Halls of Congress and all of that going on. But there's also people who are going to say, this is what people in Texas who are voting told me. This is what it was like to talk to someone who's 107 years old who came to the Capitol to ask for reparations because of the Tulsa race massacre. So I want people to feel like we are in their living room. And I think that that's the way that you stay relevant as a reporter. A lot of the questions that I ask, they come from my interviews that I've had with people in their living rooms who then are asking simple questions like, at the height of the pandemic, why don't we have testing? Why are we so behind? Why can't I figure out whether or not I'm going to be able to know if I have the pandemic and this virus, or whether or not I have a common cold? Those are the most kind of basic questions that people are asking. Those are what I was asking President Trump, and that's what we're also asking around the table.
Well, that's perfect. Why don't we go from civility and mutual respect to Donald Trump? Here's an exchange between Yamiche and Donald Trump, where Yamiche asked him about his statements that some states don't need the ventilators they were asking for. This is March 29th, obviously, of last year.
I have two questions. The first is, you've said repeatedly that you think that some of the equipment that governors are requesting, they don't actually need. You said New York might need, not need 30,000. You said it on Sean Hannity's Fox News. You said that you might.
Why don't you people act? Let me ask you.
You said some state.
Why don't you act in a little more positive? It's always trying to get
you. My question to you is,
get you. And you know what? That's why nobody trusts the media anymore.
My question to you is, how is that going to impact?
Excuse me, you didn't hear me. That's why you used to work for the Times and now you work for somebody else. Look, let me tell you something. Be nice. Don't
be threatening. Mr. President, my question
is, don't be threatening. Be nice.
I don't know if I should admit that I was cheering through every minute of that, Yamiche Alcindor. What do you feel like in the moment? You're in front of the most powerful man in the world. Virtually everybody watching, even his supporters, know that he has a strained relationship with the truth and doesn't respect women, particularly women of color, terribly much. What was in your head as you're having that exchange?
What was in my head was, if you're an American who's really, really scared right now, you want me to keep trying to get my question in. Mm-hmm. Because the question was, are we going to have enough ventilators to get people in this country still breathing if they get this virus? So to me, people were so terrified in March, right? We all remember how scared we were, how scared I was for my own family who has diabetes and all sorts of issues. So while the president was saying, you know, don't be threatening, I was thinking, okay, but like, seriously, do we have these ventilators or not?
But it's very hard to do that, as Jim just pointed out, when you are facing the most powerful. I mean, you know, a lot of us cringe just asking the selectman a question at a press conference, never mind the most powerful man on earth. So how did you, like, gear up to be able to stay calm and focused, not to, like, you know, just, I don't mean to be sexist about it, but, you know, kind of turn into a little puddle? I mean, it's really scary.
I've been a puddle, and I'm a man, Marjorie, okay, so it's not that sexist.
You know what I mean?
Well, you know, to me, maybe it's also my background as someone who's been a reporter and who has been in some tense situations with Democrats as well. I covered Bernie Sanders in 2016, and we had some really heated exchanges. I think that at the end of the day, I was so focused on thinking people are scared and they deserve a press that is representing them. And I was thinking about my family, frankly, in Miami and Boston, who were terrified, who were calling me saying, hey, what do you know about whether or not we're going to get tested? Hey, do you know if grandma gets sick, what hospital she can go to? Do you think you can get us a ventilator? Or do you have some hookup from at the White House you can help us with? People were terrified. And I, in my mind, there was no like switch to say like, this is scary. I just kept thinking, I'm a reporter trying to get a basic question out. And this man who has this job, who, yes, is the most powerful man in our country, he also literally is supposed to be at our service. He's supposed to be serving the American people. So you need to have answers for us.
So Yamiche, can we stay on Donald Trump just for one more minute and then we'll move beyond? When you read and hear stories that he's meeting with an OAN, One America news anchor, with what the guy who Marjorie calls Mr. Pillow, My Pillow, Mike Lindell, and apparently talking, it appears, seriously about how he'll be returning to power in August. What's your reflection on this?
I think it's scary stuff. I think that January 6th and the insurrection at the Capitol, for some people, and I think for a lot of reporters watching it live, we thought, okay, this is an inflection point. This is as bad as it's going to get, but we got through it. I think it might have also been a beginning of a new chapter of what democracy might be like in America, which is that it's going to be contested. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be filled with lies. That's not the way that we function. So many immigrants came to this country because we have a functioning democracy, despite all the yelling on TV and all the political issues. Our democracy actually works. And I'm really scared by the idea that there could be even a segment of our population that then says, okay, well, now that I know, former President Trump isn't going to go back into office when August comes and goes and Joe Biden is still president, I wonder if there's going to be even more violence. So that's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about, are people going to be safe? Are the lawmakers in D.C. going to be safe? Am I going to be safe covering all of this? So I think it's really scary times, and I think that we shouldn't take it lightly. Talk to any immigrant who's come from a country like Haiti or Venezuela or Nicaragua, and they will tell you democracy is fragile. Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Yamiche Alcindor, the new moderator of Washington Week, and obviously from the PBS NewsHour.
You know, Yamiche, Gwen Ifill was the moderator before you, obviously a great African-American journalist who passed away about 5 years ago. What was your relationship with her?
I was really lucky to have a great relationship with Gwen. I met her through our hairdresser. One of her best friends was my mentor, and I had been telling the hairdresser that I wanted to be a journalist for a long time, so she hooked me up with all these Black women who happened to be going to this hairdresser and paying much more money than I was in college because I could afford nothing. And she really took me under her wing and gave me great advice. And really, a lot of her advice was telling me that you can do this. I remember one incident in particular. I was booked on Meet the Press for the first time, and I was terrified. I was like, oh my God, it's Chuck Todd. There are all these smart people. I don't even understand what I'm doing. It's 2016. I'm this young kid. Like, what in the world am I doing at this table? And Gwen said, you know everything. You know just as much as everyone around the table. You are ready for this. Come prepared. Do what you always do, and you will be fine. And I think that I take that to heart. I remember when I got the Washington Week job, I was emotional and I was scared, thinking, can I really be an anchor? Like, is that really what I'm going to be now? And I just kind of almost heard Gwen say that again, like, you've earned this. You can do this. You are prepared for this. And it's been going well ever since.
We're talking to Yamiche Alcindor, the moderator of a Washington Week. When I was thinking about you and Gwen Ifill, I was thinking, I think she passed away in 2016. So that's about 5 years ago. And think about the way we cover race now in the press is totally different than the way we did, never mind 5 years ago when she was moderator, when she was still doing Washington Week. But even 2 years ago, like post-Black Lives Matter, to me it seems much more raw and real. And people are stopped pretending that we don't have that it's all kumbaya land. Do you see a difference in race coverage now?
I do see a difference. I saw a difference after Ferguson, when we really had to say, yes, America really has some deep systemic racial issues. And then, of course, after the death of George Floyd, when we really had to confront the idea that we just watched a man get murdered on TV for 9 minutes and 29 seconds while an officer with his hand in his pockets squeezed the life out of him with his knee. And I think that there are a lot of people who are coming to this idea that they can just say things in a very blunt way. And I always think back to Gwen, and there was this really great clip of her when all of this stuff was happening with Don Imus, where she was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. And she said, I didn't hear any of you talk about this. I didn't hear any of you call out Don Imus. And I was like floored, because she's on Tim Russert's show, right? Like, it's like you're calling someone out on his show, but that's who she was. And Tim Russert respected that. And I think that that's kind of where we need to be. We need to be able to say, this is what's happening. There's data, all sorts of data to show that we are a country that does not treat people equally, and that from the very beginning, from 1619 on, we were not a country that saw Black people as equal people, and we built every single institution with that in mind. And if we can't say that bluntly, then I think we're doomed to fail.
You know, speaking of 1619, it just made me think, when you were at the Times, did you work with Nicole Hannah-Jones?
I did, and I will say she's a dear friend and someone who I would also consider a mentor.
So what do you make of this disaster at UNC?
For me, the UNC debacle is really sad and really unfortunate. This is absurd. I tweeted about this. She is someone who is a MacArthur genius, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a longtime New York Times reporter. The credentials speak for themselves. And she's not asking for special treatment. She's asking to be treated like everyone else who got that position, who was offered that position. And I think it's unfortunate that her life's work, which is really just telling the truth, talking about the impact of slavery on the founding of this country and the impact that slavery had on the founders of this country, that somehow can become controversial, that the truth can become controversial, and that people who have influence over UNC can use that against her to try to stop her from getting tenure. So I really hope UNC fixes this. I think that there's just no other way around it. I think that she's just so talented and is really, I think, an icon, a journalism icon, I hope that she gets the treatment that she deserves, which is...
Yeah, we're talking to you, Michelle Cinder. Can we just change gears for one second off the news? When you got this latest job of yours, I was reading some interview with you, and it coincided with me having watched a few years after the fact the first three episodes of Handmaid's Tale. And I have to say, it is an exercise in masochism on steroids. Can you tell me what I'm missing that is captivating you, please?
Captivating me for Handmaid's Tale? I mean, it's an amazing show. I think I am someone who is literally like a 6-year-old who watched Unsolved Mysteries. I didn't watch cartoons. So for me, I've always been really, really interested in a sort of dystopia and all of the different kind of scary parts of society. And I think Handmaid's Tale for me is a reminder of what could happen if we don't really... If we aren't careful about the way that we go forward.
So after you watch an episode, I've only gone through three. I don't mean to belabor this. Do you have like 4 martinis, or what do you do to recover from it?
I do drink wine, and then I have to laugh with my girlfriend. And then I have to like tell my husband, like, hey, you would have got out, right? You would have let us go to Canada before this all got this bad. And I know my husband would not. He would have been like, oh, no, it's fine, it's fine. So I just try to laugh at it.
So, Yamiche Cinder, tell people how you, I think you said you wanted to be a gerontologist or something like that when you were a kid, but that's not how things turned out. How'd you wind up becoming a journalist?
Yeah, so my first job that I wanted to be was a geriatrician, because I was raised by my mother and my grandmother, and my grandmother would always go to the doctor, so I got to know all of her doctors really well. And I thought, oh, I would love to be someone who takes care of my grandmother. But then I really realized I didn't like math or science, and I really liked writing, so... moving on, I started really just getting into writing. And then I learned about the story of Emmett Till, and learned about civil rights journalism, and learned about the power of images and just the power of journalism in the civil rights movement. And that really made me fall in love with the craft, and I've been a journalist ever since.
Well, you're doing incredible work, and it's a great elevation, I have to say. If we had a vote, we would have voted the same way. What are you doing tonight? Can you tell us?
She's only, how old are you? You mean she's
34? Don't ask her how old.
She's a baby. She's a baby.
I'm fine with it. I'm 34 years old.
Okay.
I feel quite old, but it's fine. What we're doing tonight on the show is we're looking at democracy. We're doing a show looking at all of the voting laws that are happening in Texas and Arkansas and Pennsylvania, the Republican efforts to kind of restrict voting, and then Democrats sort of scrambling to figure out how to respond. And we're also looking at some of former President Trump's musings about August, coming back in August, and what that means for the party. So I'm also going to be looking at Democracy Abroad, which is part of our extra, which is going to be looking at Haiti and other countries. I did a story this week for NewsHour about Haiti and the democratic crisis that's going on there, with violence skyrocketing, kidnappings are up 200%. So looking at what it looks like when democracy is in peril abroad and when there are challenges at home.
You know, one last thing off the first topic you're doing. Chuck Todd is with us every Thursday, and we were talking to him about the whole Manchin vote or maybe Sinema vote. We don't know. Can the... the voting rights, the two voting rights laws, including one named after John Lewis, become law and hopefully undo, or at least, undo what's happening in places, or will happen in places like Texas and other places. And Chuck's position to us was, I hope that happens, but what people are not focusing on is so many of these local laws make the referee somebody who is wildly partisan. And regardless of right. what Congress does, the final word is going to rest in the hands of a handpicked partisan soul who can undo all the reform. I think that's a fair description of what Chuck said to us yesterday, Marjorie.
And they can decide when we stop counting the mail-in vote, votes, what hours we're going to close the polls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
What do you make of that concern, Michelle Cinder?
I think it's a very real concern. Chuck Todd smartly is pointing out what is a real problem. We saw last year in the 2020 election, a lot of Republican secretaries of state say, no, I'm not going to go about this wrong. I'm not going to side with the president. And that made a lot of Republicans angry, and they figured that they needed people who were even more partisan, people who weren't just interested in being Secretary of the State, but people who were really interested, in nullifying the votes of the party that is their opposition. So I think it's a really, really scary time, and I hope that, in some ways, I really do hope that we get to a place where we can just agree on trying to let people vote and letting the chips fall where they may, and not subscribing to this idea of having to nullify someone's vote if we don't agree with them.
Amen. We'll be watching it tonight. Amisha, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm happy. And when maybe I come to Boston and visit family, I'll see you guys.
We would really love that.
That would be terrific. And like I said, I hope all 150 of them are listening today. Good thing for us if they are. Thank you very much.
Be well,
Thank
Yamiche.
You very
Thanks.
Much, Yamiche, for joining us.
Thank you.
Yamiche Alcindor is the moderator of Washington Week, which you can catch Friday nights right here at 8 o'clock on GBH 44. If you are outside the area, check your local PBS station for listings. Yamiche Alcindor is also the White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and a political contributor for NBC News and MSNBC. Coming up, Michelle and Barack Obama are back with a civics lesson for an unschooled America. Kelly Crosser joins us for that and more. She's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us as she does every Friday is the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley. That, of course, would be Kelly Crossley. Hey there, Kelly.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
Fine. Hey, we got a lot of great stuff to talk to you about. Before we get to it, though, a little breaking news. Jim announced it before that Facebook has said it's going to suspend Donald Trump, former president, of course, from its accounts for 2 more years. Following its finding, Facebook reported that the president stoked violence ahead of the deadly January 6th insurrection. What do you make of this? What do you think? How big of a deal do you think this is? Why does it matter?
Well, I think it matters because I'm actually surprised they took any significant action because they were sort of in a corner. I mean, they didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, they're trying to figure out what's the best place to be for the company, but what's also the best place to be for distributing public information. And as much as Facebook would like to think of itself as completely private, it actually isn't. And as much as it would like to think of itself as not having contributed to the dissemination of bad information, really bad information that incited all kinds of not just in this instance, but other violent situations, that, you know, they had to take some responsibility. So I think they did the best they could do in this. Now, the 2 years thing is interesting to me because essentially what that does is put him out of play on Facebook. He will be in play other places for the next round of, you know, election stuff.
But not Twitter. I mean, Twitter, as far as I understand, is permanent and isn't being reconsidered. Am I not right?
Yeah. So, again, in both instances, in both Facebook and Twitter's instances, it was the amplification. Not really his putting it out there as much as it was how everybody else amplified it. And we amplified it. I'm saying we, not, but you know what I mean. The community of people who could amplify it, journalists and others, because he had the job that he has. He doesn't have that job now. So we'll see whether that makes a difference. Some said there is some indication of that because his own blog went away. I don't think that's really it. I think that maybe just wasn't a good. I don't know how they programmed it. I wasn't paying attention to it, but I think he'll be back and probably be back strong in some way, and probably Twitter will contribute to that.
Well, let me tell you, I'm not sure I agree. I'm more optimistic in terms of this. And by the way, this 2 year suspension, they could suspend him further at the end of the 2 years. They'll reconsider, you know, at the end of 2 years. But Chuck Todd had an interesting thought yesterday about the trumps the folding of his ancient blog thing is he said people were interested in him, I'm paraphrasing Trump, when you were forced to listen, meaning you're one of the 90 million Twitter followers. It was forced into your account. Obviously, you chose to follow him. You have to go out of your way. You had to go out of your way to get any information from him on his blog, and almost nobody did, which is actually, to me, one of the few heartening signs. Do you buy that? I do. Do you?
Not totally, because I just remember, I mean, we haven't seen him out trying to draw a crowd.
True.
But if he wanted to draw a crowd, I feel that he could. So that's people going out of their way.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. And I'm just thinking that for whatever reason, the way it was packaged and the way it was distributed just didn't work for the people who would get up,
maybe,
as they did, and drive hours, sometimes not even to get inside the building where he was, just to be outside the building. I think there are millions and millions of those people yet. And that hasn't even touched the people who still believe that he somehow is president. So I'm not quite where you all are. I'd like to think that. I do think that there is a tiny measure of laziness, so that some people who just like to, you know, be in amidst chaos, they're not going to go out of their way if chaos comes to them in the feed. Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's not a good indication that his popularity or his strength in getting people's attention in these ways has gone away.
You know, Callie, what I try to do, Marjorie knows this, so we don't announce it. I always try to do something at the end of the show if I can, or urge it on Marjorie and our colleagues, that is upbeat at the end of Friday, so that I go into the weekend on and up. But we couldn't avoid this, which is anything but.
Oh, God.
You're going to hear retired. This is almost. This is unbelievable.
I couldn't believe this. Yeah. Maybe Callie's got a different opinion. I was stunned.
Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Bernard Kempter is his
hometown
name.
Guy.
He's recounting a story about freed. This is a Memorial Day. Recounting a story about freed slaves honoring fallen Civil War soldiers, when his mic is abruptly cut off during his speech again on Memorial Day in a place, Hudson, Ohio. Here it is.
They were carrying armfuls of flowers and went to decorate the graves. Interesting that there would be a tie back to Hudson with that song from John Brown.
Most importantly, whether Charleston's Decoration Day was the first.
So let me just say what you are not hearing, except from, I guess, independent, you know, recording, because his mic was cut after he said John Brown. Most importantly, he went on to say, whether Charleston's Decoration Day was the first is attended by Charleston's black community. Someone yells out, Mike. The lieutenant general says, AJ, I assume that's the person working the thing, Mike. They cut his mic off as soon as they started talking about freed slaves supporting the fallen troops.
Well, two things. First of all, I wrote about the first Decoration Day which turned into Memorial Day, which happened in Charleston, which is the history he was trying to present there for my commentary for Memorial Day, so people can go back and see the full history, which involved our own 54th Regiment. So there is that. The second thing is, you know, people do not wish to face this history. I don't care who it comes from. I don't care how disrespectful it is. They just don't want to face the history. Their response to it wasn't relevant. What are you talking about? This is Memorial Day.
That's what
the guy's
said.
Trying to tell you about the first Memorial Day, which, by the way, was created and designed by these people who were not yet citizens and yet wanted to, you know, give honor to those who had died in the war. Maybe it was because it's the Civil War. I don't know. I'm just saying that this was it was appalling. And even if you didn't want to hear the story, if the guest speaker, you invited him to speak, you're going to cut his mic? And this is the American Legion? What the heck? I mean, it's just all of it is so crazy. So the Ohio American Legion says they're investigating. But hey, the people who cut the mic, either the chair of the parade committee or the president of the Hudson American Legion Auxiliary, fessed up and said it was one of the two of them cut the mic.
Well, by the way, they didn't do that at first, Callie. Their first thing was a technical problem.
Yeah, right.
And then when I guess somebody outed them, they then acknowledged that they cut the damn mic. It is unbelievable.
I just can't even. You know what I mean?
You know what else? It involved children, too.
Yes.
It involved, like, I think he said 3,000 black kids that were participating in this.
Marjorie, the whole story is in my commentary.
I'm going to go back. Okay. I'm going to go back. Forgive me. I didn't read the Memorial Day commentary. I'll come back and read it.
But, you know, but
that's the other thing. Children. You can't even have a nice story about black kids.
No.
But can I just say one more thing here, which I think is implicit in what you said, Callie, and it sounds like in what you wrote in broadcast, is, you know, whether it's Tulsa, which far too many of us never heard of, the massacre of 100 years ago, or I was lucky enough to have Annette Gordon Reed on TV with me the other night, her latest book on Juneteenth, talking about how black history has been just sort of wiped out of the, or never put in the history book. This is just a mini example of that. I mean, it is an amazing moment. And I would urge you guys out there, check out, go Google this moment. Lieutenant Colonel Barnard Kempter.
Yeah.
He's
shocked and appalled, by the way. We
should also say that the Ohio American Legion wants these two people involved in cutting this mic to resign. So we'll see what happens with that. But it was unbelievable. He was just, you know, you look at a guy that was a 70-year-old, you know, older patriot, loved his country. He's there in full uniform.
30 years in the Army.
Giving a wonderful speech, and they cut his microphone. And, oh, my God. Okay, I'm going to move on here.
Yeah, I mean, he was horrified and, you know, and embarrassed. And it was just disrespectful on so many fronts.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know.
To him too, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's disrespectful to, you know, his message is just disrespectful. This is your guest speaker who, by the way, is representing all of the veterans. And he has 30 years in the Army, served in the Persian Gulf War. What? This is what you do?
What is right.
Okay, we're talking to Callie Cross. We're going to keep talking to her after this brief break. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Callie Crossley continues to join us.
So here's another incredible story. There's a lot of them this weekend. This kid, senior in high school, Devarius Peters, shows up. It's down in Louisiana. He shows up at his high school graduation. He thinks he's got his family there waiting to see him walk across the stage. He thinks he's followed the dress code. He's got dark dress shoes on. He thinks because they're leather sneakers with white soles, but apparently they don't match the dress code. And what happens, Callie?
This is another one of those. But, of course, you know, I have to say that this is in the context of a whole lot of schools doing weird stuff around what the dress code is at schools, and they're very firm about it. So the young man is not supposed to wear any athletic shoes. He showed up in black leather sneakers with white soles. I'm sure they were kind of fancy because, you know, lots of people wear fancy sneakers these days.
Right.
Anyway, but the code says dark dress shoes. And so they said, you cannot walk across the stage and get your diploma. That's the only shoes he has. He's freaked out. He's panicking. He asks for a waiver. They say no. He runs over to a teacher that he spots, John Butler. He's a para educator. I'm not quite sure what that means, but it's like he mentors many of the kids at school. And I guess he's somebody that the kids recognize as a resource for them, and explain the situation. And Butler tried to advocate for him. And he's on the staff, and they said no. And so he took off his own shoes. His were a size 11. The kid was a size 9, so he was going to have to shuffle through, but he'd have on dark dress shoes. And meanwhile, Butler was there not in his role as a paraeducator, but because his own daughter was graduating. And so he went to sit down among the parents with no shoes on, and people thought he was weird. But the young man got a chance to shuffle across the stage in his big shoes and get his diploma. And the people seemed not at all moved that what they did was did not seem to make any sense. And was just, don't you think that's just cruel?
I just think it's cruel. Totally cruel.
And by the way, the story gets worse. I mean, first of all, it's a beautiful story in terms of the teacher, the paraeducator, who literally gives the shoes off his feet. But you know what? I read about 6 stories from different outlets on this today because I'm trying to learn as much as possible because it was so beautiful and so horrible simultaneously. You know what's amazing about this, which shows what a big jerk the woman who wouldn't allow him in. By the way, his parents are sitting inside, or at least his mother.
His mother saying, what are those shoes?
Right.
But
the bottom line is, he could have been left outside.
Yes.
If you noticed, the shoes that Mr. Butler lent to him aren't in compliance either.
No, they're not dark.
They're light brown, which the woman allowed in. So the point is, she could have allowed him in when he was trying to comply, and she almost died. Can you imagine? Think back to when you're graduating from high school and you're in that predicament. You know how much it means to you. You know how much it means to your parents. And you're about to be locked out literally and figuratively because of some stupid, ridiculous rule following. This story is just, it's.
And his mother was just saying how hard it was remote. Everybody knows how hard it was, and he worked so hard to, you know, make it through. And he was so proud, and she was so proud. And as she said, listen, I was able to, you know, buy at least these shoes for him. What if we couldn't afford shoes? And a lot of kids can. And yet you're going to demand that they, if they have any shoes, they're grateful to have them. And now you're, you know, what's that shoe company, Tom's? If you buy a pair, then they give a pair to somebody else. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people that don't have shoes. This could have been, it's horrible.
Well, wait, by the way, and one last thing about this. I don't mean to dwell on this, but if you guys out there read this story, you'll feel the same way the three of us do. It isn't like he was trying to be disrespectful.
No.
He had a tie on.
That's right.
He had a white shirt on.
That's
he complied with every single rule. And if you look at the athletic shoes, which, as Marjorie said, for a lot of kids, whether you can afford it or not, are essentially the equivalent of regular shoes.
That's right.
They're black, which is what it's supposed to be, and they're leather, so the only thing they're not are formal shoes. This is just so...
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous,
but
beautiful.
And he's so young-looking. I mean, he would... Imagine if this hadn't happened. He would have been devastated.
Well, how great is it that the guy gave him his damn shoes, though? Is that a beautiful moment?
I know. That was really...
Okay, we're talking to Callie Cross. We're going to keep talking to her. We have another pledge break coming up here. We're listening to 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio on a third round with Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie.
Hello.
So, Callie Crossley, I want to talk about, and we have some sound from this too, Change by her from the Obamas. This is the music, the new animated musical series they do, We the People. It's kind of a civics lesson for kids, grown-ups. It's got a lot of great music going with it. Let's hear a little sound. Here's, as I just said, the Change by her. Here it is.
Wrote a letter to the mayor. Can you hear me out? Wanna talk on all the issues that I care about. Speak free, keep the peace when we say it loud and loud. Meeting all my people at the city council.
I love that, by the way. I mean, heard that before.
There are other people, Janelle Monáe, Brandi Carlile, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Adam Lambert, goes on and on, a bunch of great musicians contributing to this. And it talks about, is that that song just did about the mayor, it talks about, you know, how many senators come from certain states, voting rights, all this kind of stuff, which we have kind of fallen down on the job on in schools.
Kind of,
yeah, totally.
You know, what happened is Sesame Street did a lot of that, and then it just drops off, you know, and people forget.
That's a good point.
Sesame Street had those little songs to teach you how a bill becomes a bill and all the rest of that stuff. But this is a series called We the People that's going to be a series of 10 music videos by the powerhouses that you mentioned, and they're very hip and happening for new generations of folk and even old generations of folk. I do note that poet Amanda Gorman is also contributing, which is good. We should note this is the show was created by under their production company with Netflix. They have this big production company, and it's Chris Nee was the originator, their creator, along with the Obamas. But it's executive produced by Tonya Davis, Priya Swaminathan, and Kenya Barris. And Kenya Barris, people may know, is connected to Black-ish, and he's got a few other big series like that. So it's really quite well-credentialed in terms of its creation. And, you know, the music is going to be good. So what a great idea.
You know, we use the term friendscape, and we borrowed it before. I'm going to friendscape a friend out of my life who I was talking to the other day who was saying, we were talking actually about this, I just read about it, and saying, well, you know, what do the Obamas really have to do with this? Well, the answer is I don't know what executive producer means, but I know that in part because of their involvement in this, some things that have happened that are really important from that. Was it called American Factory, which I think was their first thing. Mm-hmm. To this, I think this thing is so needed, this civics thing, particularly for kids, to get them in the mix and allow them to learn. So hopefully
the trailer is fantastic. I saw the trailer.
Yeah, me too. It's great. So good for the Obamas, whatever the level of involvement is.
it debuts 4th of July on Netflix. I think it's because it's really good entertainment in addition to everything else. So I think it's really exciting.
Well, an executive producer can mean many things, but most what it means is that you get to have a final say on content and focus. So, if you know, when you say that they have something to do about with it, they do have something to do about it because it doesn't get done or signed off on unless they like it.
Well, speaking of final say on content and focus, what are you doing Sunday night?
We're doing a whole hour, one of our favorite hours, with three local librarians on summer reading.
Oh, great.
Because, you know, people are coming out of the dark and alone. And a lot of our librarians, even though, as you know, they have, you know, a wide field of vision about all books, were saying to us this time, we want a lot of fantasy and a lot we're interested in something that take me away. So,
do you like fantasy, Kelly? Do you
I'm not a big fantasy
neither
person.
Neither am I.
But what I mean by that is that there's something other than just the heaviness.
Yeah.
And so even though they're obviously they give us a wide range of stuff, but all this really interesting, well-written stuff that is appealing, that'll give you a moment to just think about some other things. And there's some great suggestions on their list. So I enjoy having that conversation because I'm a big reader anyway. So it's,
I love the librarian shows.
Oh my God. And it just, you just can't do it enough. I know you all were saying that you like to end with a good thing. So
yes.
Let me say this to you. You were talking to Michelle Sender and marveling that she was 34 years old.
Yeah.
So is Dr. Kizmikia Corbett, who you may know as one of the instrumental people in the design of the Moderna vaccine. She's a black woman working with Dr. Fauci. So there you go.
And she's 34?
34. 34. Viral immunologist.
It sort of puts our own careers in perspective, I guess.
I think it's uplifting.
You know, speaking of 34, very quickly, I'm watching Washington a week or two ago when they're doing a George Floyd thing. Who's on there, formerly of the Globe and the Washington Post? Wes Lowry.
Yes,
what did he do?
Course.
Win a Pulitzer Prize in 22 or something?
He has two Pulitzer Prizes.
Yeah, he's real. You know something?
We
got to go, but it's really hard to do it. Alcindor did in those press conferences to stand up for president like that. I mean,
yes,
I would have been reduced to a puddle. She's got real guts.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, she does.
Kelly
we'll Crossy.
Be listening.
All right.
Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Kelly Crossy joins us every week, as you know, and she's the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossy's, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on GBH at 6 o'clock on 89.7. Subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Kelly Crossy. Thanks again to Callie. Monday, we're going to have the Reverend Zion Monroe with us, Emmett Price as well. Of course, he's the second Reverend. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubley, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein operate our remote studios. Jim's not on TV tonight, but Emily Rooney is. 7 o'clock, Beat the Press.
Double your money. Make a contribution. You only have 9 minutes left, 8 minutes left. Double your contribution. We thank you for doing it. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Regan. Thanks again for listening. See you Monday.
Bye.